kind of guys who'd make you feel like that. Oh no!
Hello and welcome to Today in Digital Education number 116. It's me, Doug Balshaw, and...
Me, Di Barnes. Hello, Doug. How are you doing?
I'm all right. And it's turned into like a monthly podcast now, it seems.
Well, I think it's just when our paths can cross, really, and we both lead busy lives with different demands upon us. So, and you know, some of us have to go to Lanzarote every now and then. So,
oh, it's a hard life, isn't it? So,
it's a hard knock life.
Next week, half term. What did you do?
Yeah, so I just had half term off. So it's just less than a month since we last spoke, and I went to Lanzarote for the week. Or for 4 nights last week, and just had some hot sunshine down on an African latitude, if not in Africa itself, and in one of the Canary Islands. And yeah, it was lovely, really lovely. Volcanic, there's sort of 27, 29 volcanic mountains in Lanzarote. Everywhere is covered in black lava. So it's quite interesting. Beaches aren't black sand, but I think they're man-made, to be honest, are the ones that we went on. But it was just really lovely. So walked up the odd mountain and went to a vineyard and all that kind of thing.
This sounds like a stupid question, but there used to be lots of canaries in the Canary Islands, I guess, because that's how it was named. But are there lots of canaries there now?
Well, on Lanzarote there are none. I don't know about the origins of all the other islands, but certainly Lanzarote is formed entirely volcanically and it is quite barren. There is no or very little wildlife. There are some insects and stuff like that and some birds that are generally trying to eat your food. And that was all I saw. So there weren't any pets. And I was out there with a geography teacher and he was doing some case study work for tourism and the volcanoes and stuff. Looking at taking Duke of Edinburgh projects, actually Duke of Edinburgh expeditions out there at some point in the future, which because there's some like amazing walking and it's quite hard going, and he said that there was no animals because there's no grazing, and the ground gets too hot because it's so hot there in the summer, which was a bit weird because it's all volcanic floor, it was sort of quite bizarre. But it was really, really good. It was sort of cultural difference. And, you know, he spent a couple of days in a bar drinking beer, playing cards. It was swimming in a very cold sea, which was very, very beautiful color and things like that. So I've never been to Lanzarote before, but it's the first package holiday destination that tourism ever sort of came up with. And so it has a really bad reputation, but it's not that bad. I ate fantastic food, cheap and expensive. It was lovely.
So it turns out that the name Islas Canarias is likely derived from the Latin name Canary Insulae, meaning Islands of the Dogs, a name that was applied only to Gran Canaria. According to the historian Pliny the Elder, the king Juba II named the island Canaria because it contained vast multitudes of dogs of very large size.
Okay, so canine rather than canary. Mm. And that's quite interesting in the etymology. That makes more sense. I didn't see a dog while I was there, not one. So.
Well, there you go. I mean, the island of Madeira, you know, off Portugal, I remember finding out about that because my parents have been there a couple of times. I was reading a book about the slave trade because actually I think that was where slavery began in the kind of Western world. Uh-huh. In terms of logging, because Madeira was covered with trees and then there's like hardly any there now. At one time, I think they actually cleared all the trees off the island. Interesting.
Okay. Well, all of the foliage, as it were, the flora, looked as though it had been placed deliberately on the island. So all the palm trees.
Okay.
There were places that were quite green and houses that had been there a long time up in the mountains and things like that were covered in plants and quite clearly looked after. But I don't really know. I could have done with some more time to get to grips with that and understand it in more detail. But we just, you know, we weren't there for that. We're just there for, you know, I had a bit of a run and I did a bit of swimming.
Well,
and
you can always go back, can't you?
It was quite interesting. I'm not sure I rushed back, but it certainly served its purpose for the February half term, let's put it that way.
Well, there's a place just while we're talking about islands, two things. We almost went to Ponta Delgada, which is, you know, on the Indiana Jones series of films, they would cut to the map and then they'd have the little red line showing Indiana Jones going around the world.
Yeah.
Well, one of the places he always went to was the Azores, or at least he did on the computer games versions I played. And so I was always fascinated with the Azores and Ponta Delgada. Ryanair flies there to the Azores from London, and it's pretty cheap. So we almost went there, but it turns out it rains most of the year because it's right in the middle of the Atlantic.
Oh, okay.
And then the other thing was that I have always been a fan of maps. In fact, I'm surprised I wasn't a geography teacher instead of a history teacher. But there's a place called Ascension Island.
I've heard of that.
Yeah, right in the middle of the Pacific. Oh, the Atlantic. And it's used as a stopping off point on the way to the Falkland Islands for RAF pilots.
Yeah.
And I was always fascinated by this place. And I really wanted to always go there. And I remember when I was at university, I told somebody who was doing my life, I was doing my lifeguard training, and I mentioned this, and it turns out she grew up on the RAF base on Ascension Islands. She said it was awful. She would never go back. She couldn't wait to escape the place. And it kind of shattered my dreams. But I've always dreamt of going to like an island in the middle of the Atlantic. Because there's all these little islands. You think, oh, it must be amazing. But I guess being on them for any length of time would be terrible.
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult thing, isn't it? Because when you visit, these things always look a little bit more rose-tinted, I guess, and what they really are. And it's just quite a standard thing that people who live in small places tend to want to leave. In fact, one of my cousin's children, who I visited in Oregon in last summer, he's only 14 now, I think, and he posted on his Instagram a beautiful picture of Oregon in the snow. And said something about a small town that everybody hates and nobody leaves. And I thought it was quite interesting. And then so everyone talks about getting out, but it just seems to him that nobody does. And so I just shared a couple of sort of interesting things. So John Mellencamp does a song called Small Town, which I discovered when I was about his age. So I posted that to him, said, listen to this. He ended up living back where he grew up. And so did Bruce Springsteen. I watched a documentary over Christmas about Bruce Springsteen where he's doing a live gig and playing his songs, just him and a guitar, and talking about his life and all the things that he's learned. And he's ended up living within walking distance of the house he grew up in, after hating it and wanting to, you know, he was born to run, the whole thing, all of that. So it's quite an interesting thing about home and identity, because I don't have one personally, because I moved every 2 years when I was a child. So I'm just sort of more or less northern with a bit of southern and eastern thrown in. You know, I've got all these different sort of identities, I guess, mixed up in the melting pot, and don't really have anywhere that is home in that regard, I guess. I don't know.
Well, there we are.
Yeah. Ended up in London for 20 years. I mean, there you go.
Well, I guess, I mean, almost everyone I know has lived in London for a time. Everyone English that I know has lived in London for a time. And I guess I'm unusual in that I haven't and don't really want to.
Yeah, it's quite standard for lots of people to migrate there after university. I think it just people tend to do that. It's such a big city, big place, different things going on, I guess. But I don't miss London at all. No.
So what else have you been up to? You put Brian Cox live. Have you been to see him?
I have, yeah. So I didn't know that Professor Brian Cox, of D-Ream fame, is doing a live show, but he's done it for a couple of, this is the third year, I think he's done it or something. And they do these live shows, and it's just him with massive, fantastic audio visuals on stage. And just him and another guy who he runs a podcast with, weirdly. So we're kind of like podcast brothers, I guess.
Oh, is that the Infinite Monkey Cage?
That is the Infinite Monkey Cage, yes. And it was really good. It was really interesting. So it was a house trip. So it was an expensive house trip. We don't normally do something that expensive, but we did on this occasion. So my housemaster is a biologist. So I was quite keen for it to be a science-based, and it was very different to things we've done before, like going to watch wrestling and other such things. And so, it was a good night of Brian Cox doing his science. I mean, he is a very likable man who is the same age as me. He's a couple of years older, I think. So,
We're going to talk about MoodleNet later, but interestingly, somebody created, see if I can find it now, somebody created a Brian Cox fan club as a MoodleNet community.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, I mean, that is the deal. He is really interesting to listen to. His whole show, the point of his show was a bit lame, to be honest. So it was, so what he does is he tries to orient where we are in the world, in the universe, in space time, basically. And there's lots of interesting things that you pass through as he's talking and lots to think about. And, you know, at some point you think Eureka, another point you think, what the flip is he talking about? Or, you know, what is the point of all of this? And he comes down without, well, giving, you know, huge spoiler, please turn off now if you're going to see it, but just enjoy it while you're here. Enjoy the ride. That's kind of what he was saying. And just appreciate the glory and splendor of the world and what we know about it and what we're finding out about it. But the perspective of what he's putting, what he gives you, as in the billions of solar systems that exist, it just puts you in a sort of very strange a place of, you know, you're here for a wink of an eye. And you just to make the most of it, enjoy it as much as you can, was the deal. So
have you read Brian? It's quite old now, I guess 15, 16 years old. But have you read Bill Bryson's A Short History of Almost Everything?
I have not read that, no.
Because I've been meaning to read that for ages, and then I just had it on my e-reader, and I thought, I'm going to start reading that now. And I guess I haven't seen Brian Cox live, but from what you say, it's a similar kind of thing about trying to grasp the gargantuan nature of space and how small you are in the big scheme of things.
Yeah, I mean, that is essentially a lot of it. And a lot of just understanding carbon, and that carbon, there's a finite amount of carbon in the world, and we're just recycling carbon all of the time. And, you know, a lot of these things you sort of want to scientifically poo-poo in a way, even though he obviously knows a lot more about it. And that's one of the things that he comes from, is this position of expertise, I guess, where you just have to sort of accept what it is that he's saying, and you're not really in an informed position to critique it. So you just have to take it and crack on. But really, I mean, it was a good way to spend 2.5 hours. It was just the same as what's on the telly with a better TV. Really. because the screen is so awesome and the sound is so loud, it rattles through your body, so it's quite powerful in that way. It's cool.
Well, last week,
go on,
during half term, usually it's a bit of a democracy, and we all decide what we're going to do together. But you know what it's like with when you try and get everyone to have a consensus view, you end up with a bit of everything and nobody really likes it. So Hannah, my wife, took things in hand and decided that because I had to be away and working and it's kind of crunch time, that I was going to take 2 days and we're going to go early Monday, come back Tuesday night, and we're going to pack in loads of stuff. So have you ever been to Jorvik in York?
The Jorvik Centre, yeah.
Yeah, so Jorvik Viking Centre. I must have been there. The last time I was there must have been almost 30 years ago when I was about 9. And I reckon it's one of the reasons that I got so interested in history, because it's the sights and smells and stuff. For people who haven't been there, you go around on almost like this really slow roller coaster and you see this place come to life based on all of the excavations they've done at York, Jorvik. Uh-huh. And things talk to you and you can smell it. And it was just, it's incredible, even better now. So we went there in York, and we also went to the Magna Science Adventure Centre, which used to be this almost mile-long steel factory near Rotherham, or in Rotherham, and they've turned into the Science Adventure Centre, which is incredible. And then we went to Fountains Abbey as well. So it was kind of a mixture of all the things that Hannah likes, i.e. science, and all the things that I like, i.e. history. And the kids loved it, and we just had a great time.
Oh, fantastic. The Jorvik Centre was flooded some 10, 12 years ago or something, and they've completely redone it. It was closed for like 2 or 3 years. They spent a lot of time and money on it.
It was great. And interesting, we went back because it just happened to be coincidentally, we had already booked ages ago that Hannah and I were going away to York on Saturday. And we missed it with the kids, but there was I think it's finishing tomorrow. There's a Viking week because I think it's half term for some people this week, so they wanted to spoil the two. So Viking week, and when we went on Saturday outside York Minster, there were thousands of people dressed up as Vikings, like doing parades, and there was crafting and people drinking lots of beer out of horns and all sorts of things.
Okay, cool. Sounds good.
Yeah.
Cool. Right. So what else have I been doing? So not a lot. I got this very weird thing. You'll have to watch it later. It's a YouTube video. So I tweeted it out this morning. So I got this Instagram advert for something called the Biohackers Handbook. And it was really, really interesting because I couldn't work out whether it was a spoof or not. And it's not, it doesn't seem, but I was just fascinated by it, but it has a lot of the things in there. So it came on and it was like, you know, it's all the things about, using health data to streamline your life and becoming fantastic at eating and, or, you know, very efficient and doing the best of all of the things that you do. So it had like body mass index scales on it, which you've got, which you've talked about before. It had an AeroPress in it. It was looking at different kind of food types and then it was out in nature and sort of foraging and eating really clean, healthy food and just stuff like that. And I was just like, oh my God, this is like, okay, someone has worked out to target me with this. But I was just fascinated by it, really. Yeah,
I'm just looking at it. There's
has a
guys trying to, in their 20s, it would seem, trying to be more productive and live longer.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what it is. I like the idea of hacking yourself rather than being hacked. You know what I mean? And sort of improving your situation, I guess, and your body and your mind, and well-being and mindfulness and all of this sort of things. And obviously, you're going to come to this conclusion of biohacking.
I thought it was going to be like some of the stuff that we've talked about before, which is like physically changing your biology by, you know, putting magnets into your fingers or injecting stuff into your eyes so you have different type of vision. But actually, it's things like avoiding blood sugar swings so you're not stressed at work, using a standing desk properly and stuff.
Mm. Yeah. So standing desks were there. Squatting with what was he doing? Squats with, what do you call them? Kettle weights, is it? Something like that?
Kettlebells,
yeah. Yeah, so I was going to get a kettlebell to do that sort of thing with because of what I do and being barefoot. They don't actually be barefoot, but they did have barefoot shoes on at one point.
I have a kettlebell and I don't use my kettlebell very much, mainly for one reason. If you do kettlebell swings, which apparently are the best thing you can possibly do in terms of any kind of exercise, and it like destroys any fat and things, the trouble is you think that's great and I'm going to do this every day, and you do however many kettlebell swings you can do, like you get up to maybe 70 in you know, reps, in sets and reps, and the next day you can hardly walk.
Oh, okay. Well,
it's tense.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I haven't bought one. I just do the thing.
Try it. I think I'll tell you who recommends it highly and why I got it. It's Tim Ferriss in The 4-Hour Body talks about it quite a lot. And it does. I mean, in terms of like, it absolutely beats you. So yeah, I recommend doing it, but I guarantee you'll not be doing it every day.
Well, it's I've just looked at it. So I don't do any work on my upper body at all. I do chin-ups and I haven't done those for ages. I used to do them quite a lot. I'm not into the aesthetic of it so much, but I would like to be a bit stronger, I think, in the upper body, but I just can't be bothered. I like going running. I don't know. I just thought it was all quite interesting in that.
No, it is.
Everything that you think about doing and you spend time thinking about these things, that people are actually doing it, of course, and doing it with knobs on, is a no-brainer, I guess. But there it is.
Somebody once said to me, or did I read in a book, they said, think about the job that you do and how you spend most of your time. Is your body shape suited for what you do most of the time? And it was basically reacting to, you know, all these people like men on Instagram and like having all these weights and being ripped and stuff. And I think the point, oh, I'll tell you what it was. It was the School of Life series, one of their books.
Mm.
How to, and they've got a series of books called How to Think About Money, How to Think About Health. And it was making that point, like, is your body shape suited for the kind of work that you do? Like, and so I do a lot of work on the computer. So actually being huge and ripped and not being able to put my arms by my sides because I've got such huge muscles would probably be a disadvantage. That's the story I'm telling myself anyway.
Mm. Yeah, no, I mean, I'm a big fan of that. So the idea that, so it's a difficult thing. So I have quite a nice body shape, I guess, which is a difficult thing. So I have quite big, I don't know what the muscles are called, the lats, the things that like the wings underneath your arm. So I have quite...
So Di's got big wings, right? Okay.
Yeah, so I've got these
bingo wings
things. So I kind of, my body spreads out and it looks like I'm muscly and I'm not. So but I think it's because of how I spent my childhood, because I was up trees and in rivers and whatever quite a lot and climbing a lot.
Are you really Batman?
I am, possibly. Some combination of Batman, Superman, Spider-Man, which are the only superheroes I knew when I was little. So
have you seen the Spider-Man film?
I haven't, no, is it good?
Oh my goodness. Incredible. I was sitting there going, I get to the end and I don't really understand what's happening. And it's like half, well, it's completely animated, but they've obviously modeled it a bit like games like FIFA or Red Dead Redemption 2, which we'll talk about in a minute. Like they've modeled it on real people, but it all looks like it's drawn. And at the end, the whole world's collapsing in on itself. And you don't really know what's happening, but it's all incredible. And the soundtrack's fantastic too.
Oh, okay. Fair play. I will give it a look. Yeah, cool. I've not been watching many films recently because on the recommendation of a good friend of mine, I bought a PlayStation 4 Pro and Red Dead Redemption 2. So my television time has been sat, in fact, more than my television time.
Come on then, because I've talked about how amazing Red Dead Redemption 2 is on this podcast, and you have decided to buy it, and you've played it, and you've got a better PlayStation than me. You've got the Pro. So tell us all about it.
Well, I think it's the Pro bit that makes, no, I think it's, I don't know what difference it makes. Anyway, it's right. So you're Rocky and you're an old cowboy who's older than me, it seems, or more or less, or no, possibly 40 years old, something like that. But he's quite an older person. And he rolls around doing stuff. So I've played it on the story mode. I've not played it online yet. Just going through the story, which is what I really enjoy because that's how I used to game when I was a kid. I've not done this sort of online multiplayer gaming thing. And it's phenomenal. So they have spent so much. So I remember back in the day playing a game, I can't remember the name of now, but it was like GTA, so Grand Theft Auto, but based in London. And I think, I don't know if it was Rockstar that did that actually, but they spent 5 years mapping London in all of its detail. And London is enormous. And you can just poodle around there being in London. Well, I lived in London, so it was quite exciting, but not that exciting. But where I don't live is in the wild west of the northern United States of America. Wow. It's where I was essentially in Idaho and Oregon last summer. A lot of it's just like that, where I was whitewater rafting and things. It's, you know, big mountains with snow-capped tops in the middle of summer and fir trees lining all the way up the mountain, these big rivers coming down. Really, really amazing. It's like one of my favorite environments in which to spend time. And here I am.
Play games. Like, because we were talking just before we hit record, and I was saying how sometimes I just go around on my horse on Red Dead Redemption 2 and look around at the view. I've got it on a big projector with my headphones on, so it's really immersive.
And well, I just got it on a standard.
Wander around on my horse just going, this is lovely. And for people who don't play games, they wouldn't really get that, I think.
No, absolutely. I've just got it on a standard HD TV, and I haven't put it on my 4K monitor yet. I don't know if it'll be any better on the 4K. But it really is just beautiful. The sounds, they just thought about all of that stuff. They crafted this environment beautifully. Your interaction with the environment is sometimes a bit blocky and has to be crass, but mostly it's smooth and responsive to like the rocks and the different ravines and, you know, the bits of bots you're walking in. You're on your horse and it's kind of, you're just chilling out doing the thing, and then you get to go hunting and you get to kill all these real things where no real animals are hurt. And
that was a bit weird for me, actually. So a couple of weird things this week, or in the last few weeks. I was avoiding eating meat-flavored crisps. And my kids went, why, when they haven't got any meat in? I was like, yeah, but it feels a bit weird. And then Red Dead Redemption 2, the whole point is you're in the American West. Like, you kill animals and you skin them and you eat the meat. And I was like, oh, but it's not real, so it's okay. But it
kind you just went around eating all the herbs.
Yeah,
there's no that. Well, that is the thing, though, isn't it? And wasting as well. Like, you leave these dead carcasses after you've skinned them for their pelts. You leave them on the floor, and you've taken the meat from them, but you don't take the whole meat, obviously, because you can't carry a whole deer with you, or whatever. Mm. And it's just a bit of a waste. You think, oh, I don't want to leave that there, and things like that. But you have this slider that comes up whenever you do something good or bad. This slider comes up at the bottom, this spectrum thing, and your position is on it, whether you're bad to the left or good to the right. And so I've been working my way up the good side, even because you have to do bad things. You just get into these positions where you've got to kill people and do, you know, cold-blooded murder and things like that. And you just have to really realize, okay, I can't be a good man in this game. You just have to be a baddie in a certain ways. And yet you're penalized for being, so if you do loads of bad things, then people, the law just come after you and kill you.
I've written a blog post about this on Thought Shrapnel. So, where was it? It was on Engadget. They wrote about an update to Red Dead Redemption 2 that, because there's lots of people called griefers, and actually we'll talk about a pretty sinister version of griefing in terms of YouTube kids after this maybe. But griefers are people who like making other people's lives a misery.
So yeah, it's like trolling, isn't it, really?
It's like trolling, but in a game environment, it's people who just try and like pick on people to kill them all the time, kind of thing. Anyway, let's just read a couple of quotations from here, because I think it's really relevant, not only to gaming, but to how we do things in education too. So the first quote, maybe I'll read that one, you read the second one. It says, quote, The update to Red Dead Redemption 2, the update also brings a new system that highlights especially aggressive players. The more hostile you are, the more visible you will become to other players on the map with an increasingly darkening dot. Your visibility will increase in line with bad deeds, such as attacking players and their horses outside of a structured mode, free roam mission or event. But if you start behaving, your visibility will fade over time. Rockstar, who make the game, is also introducing the ability to parlay with an entire posse rather than individual players, which should also help reduce how often players are killed by trolls, end of quote.
Yeah, so you basically have an interesting thing in response to your playing style, if you like, the character that you assume and how you take it. You create opportunities for, you make yourself vulnerable by doing that, because you bring attention to yourself and they sense the people after you and whatever.
Right.
The second quote. The update will also see the arrival of bounties. Any player that's overly aggressive and consistently breaks the law will have a bounty placed on their head. And once it's high enough, non-playing characters, so as in computer characters, bounty hunters will get on your trail. Another mechanism to dissuade griefing, but perhaps a missed opportunity to allow players to become temporary bounty hunters and enact some sweet vengeance on the players that keep ruining their gameplay. So the idea there is that you're trying to do things, like you're trying to do good things and help people and build things and whatever, and people can come along and just smash it all apart and put you in back you into a corner, so you have to become a baddie and behave in ways that you don't want to.
Well, the point I was making in this post is that in education, or you know, we tend to exclude or ban things that we don't like, rather than, because obviously Rockstar Games is dealing with customers here, so that they're trying to make some kind of environment where things get better. So what they're doing is they're creating a system to make it a bit more self-policing And also, if there's outliers of people who are doing deviant stuff, then they bring them into line through game mechanics. And I was just thinking how we could do the same in learning mechanics, and also not banning people from doing stuff, but more like socially dissuading them from doing it.
Yeah, well, this is a really interesting thing. Should we go here? Let's go here. Okay, so I taught a lesson recently. So I'd watched some documentary, and it's about the social credit system. So I watched it on The Guardian. We've talked about it before, a little 10-minute video, but I realized that the source of that video was a half-an-hour news report by the Australian Broadcasting Company on the social credit system that's going on in China. And the way that the video is called something like, oh God, it's got the word dystopian dictatorship, China's dystopian dictatorship. Now I teach a few Chinese students. So in the classes with those children in, I would teach this lesson, and I taught it to different age groups to see what response I'd get. And so I showed them that video. Then I showed them another video about this lanyard that you can get that you wear at work, which has two cameras in it, an infrared sensor, Wi-Fi in it, obviously Bluetooth in it as well. And it records everything you do whilst you're at work. And it doesn't record physical conversations, but it'll record the temperature of the conversation, the tone of it, and how long you spend talking to someone. It will record how long you spend writing an email, how long you spend in meetings, which meetings you're invited to. And it's been invented by, it's called Humanize with a YZE on the end. And so I showed them these two things. I'll not get sidetracked by that. I showed them these two things. So the social credit system, and I only showed 10 minutes of the video in which this woman called Dan Dan is extolling the benefits of the social credit system. So she's part of the Chinese middle class. She works in advertising or PR or something. And she's loving it. And then it reveals towards the end of the clip that I showed that her husband works for the justice system out there somewhere. And she has a top score, you know, nearly full 773 points out of the 800 possible. And so the idea with the social credit system is that as you lose points, you lose privilege. So you can't apply to certain universities. You won't be allowed to use public transport, et cetera, et cetera. And it even tracks. It's all done through CCTV and facial recognition. Okay. So there's no one actually doing anything to you. It's all done through algorithms. Even the stuff that you buy in a shop, for example, if you're buying nappies, that's a sort of plus to your social credit score because you're looking after other people.
It was the same as that article, that video-based article. Yeah,
in The Guardian, exactly. Right. So that said, so I showed them these two things, and then I said, okay, we talked about it a little bit. Like we said, what age should it be when you get your first social credit score, when you start on the social credit score system? You know, should you be 10? Should you be 15? Should you be 21? What should it be? So we talked about these things and talked about the things. And then I said, okay, what I want you to do now is I want you to build a social credit system for our school. I said, so teachers will no longer be able to issue you with detention or any punishments or rewards. I said, the only way that you're going to be punished or reward is through your social credit score. They broke up into groups and they had to do like one person was responsible for working out what would add points, what activities would add points or achievements would add points to your score, what would take points away, obviously, was another one. And then the other two people would have to work out what happened at what level of score. And when the score was refreshed, would you get a new, fresh start every term? And what privileges you would get and what privileges would be taken away at different levels, you know? And so it was a really important thing. And then I get them started on that. And after about 3 or 4 minutes, I'd say, okay, I just want to clarify here. I want you to wear the shoes of the algorithm writers. So I want you to create a humane system, a system that you would like to be part of, that it would work for you, not one that you would resent and think was dreadful, but one that you think was fair and just, and to try and work out, because in the main, algorithm writers aren't trying to screw you over. They're trying to do the right thing, but they're limited, as with all sort of research, they're limited by their own bias and prejudices that they carry with them and they're not really aware of. And I said, so I want you to try and interpret this into it's how you make the community a good community in which everyone can achieve what it is that we're here to do, which for you to have a good, well-rounded education, whatever that might mean. I want you to be able to reward and indeed penalize people who are not doing very well at that and do the thing. But I want it to be something that you understand. And they weren't allowed. So the things that weren't allowed to do were like tickets to Alton Towers or, you know, tickets to the local cafe or something like money, you know, money prizes. They had to give internal awarding prizes like extra pudding at lunch or something like that. So we went down that sort of line. Okay. But there wasn't enough time to get to something like what we have here. But obviously Rockstar do have that time. They do have that capacity to actually make it work. And they've come up with these game mechanics to try and influence people into doing the right thing. It's interesting.
Yeah, definitely. Well, talking about being influenced by what you see, just before we kind of started tonight, I saw something quite disturbing, which was shared on Mastodon. It's on Boing Boing. So Cory Doctorow, who we talked about lots on this podcast, has picked up on, you know, we talked about griefing in that, in the environment, like online games environments. So you play a lot of the story mode. I play a lot of like the online against each other mode, which is why you get griefers and trolls and whatever. Well, this particular griefer is, I mean, I'm almost scared to share this with my wife because she'll never let my kids watch YouTube ever again. Basically, this guy has been showing normal, like, cartoony videos, and then 4.5 minutes in, like, once the parents walked away and the kids watching them by themselves, it says, 4 minutes and 45 seconds into the video, a man quickly walks onto the screen, holds his arm out, and taught the children watching this video how to properly kill themselves. Basically, it said the 4 minutes and 4 minutes and 45 seconds. The man walks onto the screen, holds his arm out, traces his form out, and says, "Kids, remember, cut this way for attention and this way for results," and then walks off again.
Oh my God, I haven't heard about this at all.
No, it's the first time I heard as well.
So, a student sent me something the other day, and I was really concerned. It shows a little bit too much about how I teach, but it was a little bit concerned about that I see something, and it was that Walt Disney. So we were looking at copyright, and I was showing him the really old Walt Disney mashup of copyright, you know, of all the different clips from Disney, and which is a really cool little video. And they said, "You must see this, you must see this." And Disney had just pulled their advertising off YouTube with a couple of other big companies as well. And the reason that they've done it is that YouTube is, there's this fantastic 20-minute expose this guy has done, a YouTuber has done, showing how in YouTube comments is becoming a syndication of a soft core child abuse pornography ring. And they're communicating through videos, and the videos start. So, and he did an analysis, and within five clicks, you can get from an innocent child video to videos of children that children themselves are put up on YouTube, but they're dressed sort of a bit explicitly or a bit rudely. And it's kind of, you know, the purpose of it is for, you know, if it's done innocently by the people who are putting it up, but the people who are watching it, their motivation is not innocent. And it is pedophiliac. Pedophile.
Wow.
In nature. It's just quite interesting. And so YouTube are having to address that right now. And this also comes back on the idea that Instagram, since we last spoke, Instagram have responded to the girl that killed herself because of the suicide stuff that's getting up on, the self-harm stuff that's going up on Instagram, and being fed out to people, and Instagram aren't doing anything to take it down and control it. And Instagram have publicly come out and said they will address this issue. They will work it out.
It's difficult for people like Instagram and Twitter and Facebook, though, because they don't want to be, and YouTube, they don't want to be classified as publishers, because that means they're subject to regulation and different taxes and whatever.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely.
But at the same time, they can't be seen to do nothing about these things. And the particular problem here is, so that video that I just mentioned and the self-harm, from what I understand, the Instagram thing, the algorithm was recommending self-harm videos and content to that person, but their algorithm is kind of dumb, and in the same way that, you know, the YouTube algorithm is dumb too. So it just learns from the kind of stuff that you like, and it could be literally anything at all.
But it's not just, I mean, this is the sort of thing we discussed, you know, that Wired video of the interview with Tristan Harris and Harari as well, Noah Harari. So Tristan Harris talks about something interesting there, which is the idea if you drop what he calls drop a human animal into a YouTube video on dieting, teenage girl into a YouTube video on dieting, and she's watching it because she's conscientious about what she's eating and her changing body and how she can diet to address any her body shape, I guess. And that where you go from that is that wouldn't it be fantastic if YouTube actually ran humane algorithms that noticed that there was a girl of a certain age was looking at a certain type of video, and this was a very vulnerable position for that girl to be in, and then to lead her not into bad places, but to lead her into healthy places of mindfulness and well-being and where she can get support and things that are going to be good for her. But instead, what it will do is it will look at, okay, so what other videos do teenage girls spend more time that keeps them hooked into YouTube? And it will undoubtedly be something darker, more to do with eating disorders and that kind of thing. And I think that is interesting is these recommendations that are made. And he cites in there that 70% of all YouTube videos watched are watched through recommendations rather than through dropping in and search query response. It's interesting stuff.
Did we talk about the Rutger Bregman Davos thing last time?
Davos, where they all met recently. No, go on.
And Rutger Bregman, we talked last year about his book Utopia for Realists, which I recommended. He's a Dutch historian. He must be about 30 or something like that. And he was invited to a panel to talk about the future and how it was just basically capitalists inviting someone else onto the panel to give a different view. And he just went off on one. I'll link to it. Him and someone else as well. Went off on one and said, like, the underlying thing here is capitalism and you guys, none of you paying taxes. That is the problem here. It's like going to a firefighters conference and no one can talk about water. And he goes off on one. It's fantastic if you haven't seen it. And here, it's kind of, everyone's going, oh my goodness, Facebook, who are on Instagram, and Google, who are on YouTube, they should do something about this. But they literally earn money, like you've just said, Di, from people spending more time on site. And there's a definite link, obviously, between serving ever more radical content and people staying and clicking and pressing buttons and adverts. So we can't really expect to get good outcomes when the thing which is motivating them is the exact opposite of that.
I think that's right, but I think it's wrong, and I'll tell you why. So where it's possibly not so bleak. So I think one of the important things is, and something that we're trying to do in schools all of the time, and you'll be doing as well with your own children, is to make people more active agents in what they're doing and in their participation in their consumption of what's going, what they watch, read, listen, whatever in their web. And so ultimately, right, so I understand that in its infancy or indeed its toddlerdom, maybe that we have of the web, of YouTube, of social media, of these streams of content that we've got, they are doing that. They are serving the shareholder and they are doing all of those things that you're saying. But isn't it going to be inevitable that they have to pull away from that to do something better? Like to recognize when their viewer, their user, their customer is in a vulnerable position or something and to sort of possibly push them somewhere else. For these things to become more mature and get more sophisticated and to actually serve a different purpose in a different way, because it will actually serve the company's interests to be better at that sort of thing in the long run. So if everyone starts banning YouTube everywhere because it contains this sort of shit, and it's so hidden that no one can identify it, not even Google with their enormous algorithmic power, can get there. Then you have to sort of ban it. And then when YouTube's, so the problem with it is, if you think, right, so Instagram and YouTube don't allow nipples, for example, so they can deal with nudity, and they have algorithms that can do that. But what they haven't done is put the investment, because they just decided that, okay, that's a line that we cannot cross. We cannot go into pornography. So that's how we're going to cut the line there, is that no nipples will be shown. And and but they're not making the effort to do this stuff because it's not on their agenda enough. And slowly but surely, pressure will build on them to actually deal with this, which is kind of what we're seeing now, is that pressure will build. And that is the way that capitalist democratic pressure in a free market, that building pressure is the thing that changes and influences. It is not somebody on a moral high horse. That doesn't work. It has to be that critical mass, doesn't it?
Well, I'd like to think so. And the only kind of analogy I can draw is that it benefits society not to have lots of people who are homeless, yet homelessness has increased recently, and plenty of people ignore, step over people begging for money on the streets. Yet, like, I don't think anything's inevitable. I don't think any time we think things are going to get better because people are good or organizations are good. I think people and especially organizations respond to incentives. And if the regulatory framework is either non-existent or allows them to carry on regardless and make lots of money through doing whatever, they've got a legal obligation to their shareholders. Now, it might come a time when their shareholders go, actually, you need to be responsible to society. But you can see by the fact that Amazon pay less tax than I do, that there's no appetite really for a meaningful regulatory framework.
I think as it stands, I think that's a fair comment. I imagine Amazon pay more tax than you do, not necessarily in the UK, and but they might. Not, I don't know. I'm one or the other. I just suspect. But the point being is that the incentives for these things to happen take time, and everything that's here now. It's right that you and I are outraged by this stuff, and that we are inspired by people who are calling them out, and that we act upon that. But it's important that we act upon it, because that is the thing that creates the pressure, and the pressure will have its effect, because at the end of the day, they want you and me and our children and our children's children to be using their service. And they have to do that. But there is also the thing that everyone's scared of, I think, which is that they're just too big. No, you know, all this stuff that we talk about, the barriers to entry, the collusion that goes on about the infrastructure that Amazon, Google, Facebook are all putting together at the moment, or, you know, we talked about just before Christmas, I think it was, where they're, they're creating essential barriers to entry. So it's impossible for new comers to get in on the act, as it were.
No, I think that's true. And I think that one thing that kind of tip me over the edge to think, look, I can't be spending my life trying to fight every moral crusade ever, was just, there's a lot of, and it feels like victim blaming. It feels like, oh, individuals should sort this out by doing more recycling or being conscious about their shopping choices or the technology they use or whatever. And you think, actually, this is not individuals' problems. It's being painted as individuals' problems because we live in this neoliberal atomistic society where everyone's supposed to be masters of their own destiny and stand up and see themselves as different to other people. Actually, what's needed here is controls on monopolies, like you just said, and regulation and stopping people before they do get too big. And it reminds me of kind of a discussion we had on Twitter about individual steps to tackle climate change.
I was just looking for that, and then I realized I posted it from your newsletter. I've just picked that tweet up. So absolutely, this is a fascinating thing, and this, because you posted this just after the young people's protest that went on, all the activation by school pupils that happened throughout, was it just this country, or was it throughout Europe or throughout the world? About climate change, that you must act, you know, you can't sit there. And it's the individual steps to tackle climate change, isn't it?
It is. But as I say in that post, These are all important steps, but industry and big business like completely dwarfs anything that we can do, even collectively as individuals. But it all counts. Like, we should do something, but at the same time, like, we could all do something and it makes no difference because big business is just carrying on regardless.
Oh, I think this is true, but it's, you still have to do the bits you can do. So with the geography teacher that I was on holiday with, we talked about this, and we talked about, you know, like me recycling, for example. It's just, is there any point in doing it? And things of that nature. And then, but if you look at the top five things that an individual can do to have an impact, they're really interesting. So at number five, you have a plant-based diet. Number four, you have switching to an electric car, switch from an electric car to be car-free, so you don't have a car. Four is this is buy green energy. Number three is avoid one transatlantic flight. Two is live car free. So the other one was switch electric car to car free. I don't know what that means. And then number one is to have one fewer child in your family. And I thought this was really interesting. And I wondered how many people protesting would A, live without a car, and B, not that I was having a go at the kids, like, but just people in general, but also avoid flying. So in the last 4 years, I have flown hundreds of miles, thousands and thousands of miles around the world, going on holidays, seeing great places, doing great things. And it has increased my cultural appreciation of this, that, and the other, and been an amazing experience and improved me as a human being, all of these things. But the truth of it is, that it is really not good for our planet. And I'm very much aware of that. As soon as I get onto that to booking a flight, I just think, oh my gosh, I'm going to step on there with all that planet killing energy. And I'm going to contribute to it by being a customer of it.
I wonder how, you know, when you book flights, I don't think on EasyJet and stuff, but when you book them on like KLM and things, it allows you to offset your carbon emissions by paying more for them to plant trees. I wonder if they actually do that and if it has any impact.
Well, this is an interesting thing, isn't it? It's very hard. It's like Ecosia, you know, the search engine that you can use that plants trees, contributed to every internet search that you do. Right. And they plant a tree per however many internet searches. And whether those things are actually doing any good, like I buy toilet rolls from tree sustainable companies. That's what I look for. It's like, we plant trees. That's how we do what we do. And I'm always kind of curious, oh, did they really do something? And I'm just falling for a marketing ploy here.
Well, that's the thing. Like, to what extent is it another form of marketing? I think, isn't it?
But I heard this really interesting argument on Radio 4 driving somewhere over the half term in about palm oil. And so you had one body on saying, ban palm oil. Palm oil is really bad. It's destroying rainforest galore. And then another person came on and said, actually, we don't want to ban palm oil, and we don't want to give a mixed message. We are never, in the complicated food economy of the world, we are never going to ban palm oil. Therefore, we need to increase the use of sustainable palm oil. And so 19% of the world's palm oil is produced sustainably at the moment only. That's only a fifth. And so the products, it's not that palm oil is bad for you. It's a really good product for the human body as far as we know at the moment. But it's really bad for the planet because of the destruction to the rainforests and all the deforestation that's going on and has gone on. And yeah, so I think that's a really interesting thing, is that there are mixed messages within climate care and carbon footprints and things like that. And we need to really get to the bottom of all of this. It's like, so would you ever say that China are fantastic because they have a one child per family policy, or did have? Everyone thought they were dictators and dreadful. Well, actually, maybe they were saving the world.
Yeah, that's not the reason they did it. But yeah, I know what
you mean. I know it's not the reason they're doing it, but, you know, still.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to argue against things like this, to say, like, we should, because this is the kind of society I want to live in. Have you ever come across solar punk before?
Solar punk, no.
So I hadn't either, but there's some people in the kind of places that I hang out these days on Mastodon who are really into solar punk. And in fact, one of the MoodleNet testers created a solar punk community in MoodleNet. So let's have a look. Solar punk. Let's have a look at one of the things. Oh, what's it doing? It's just gone to a different page. Solar punk is a genre of speculative fiction that focuses on craftsmanship, community, and technology powered by renewable energy, wrapped up in a coating of Art Nouveau blended with African and Asian aesthetics. It envisions a free and egalitarian world with a slight bend towards social anarchism, standing as both a reaction to the nihilism of cyberpunk and a solution to what love the problems we face in the world. Solar punk works look towards a brighter future, solar, while deliberately subverting the systems that keep that brighter future from happening. Punk.
Okay.
So quite a few people identify as solar punk because it's like very left wing. It's hopeful. It involves like green stuff. And it's also got a really interesting aesthetic.
It does have a really interesting aesthetic, one that appeals to me, which makes me suspicious. But it's tropes. What are tropes? TV tropes. A trope is a storytelling device or convention, a shortcut for describing situations a storyteller can reasonably assume the audience will recognize. Tropes are the means by which a story is told by anyone who has a story to tell. We collect them for the fun involved.
Well, that's TV Tropes, which is actually an amazing website, and you could easily lose an afternoon down that rabbit hole. But maybe a different one is Solar Punk, a reference guide by a guy called Jay, Jay's on our Slack channel, I think. So here we are, Solar Punk, a reference guide. So this is a Medium post, and he just talks about like what solar punk is and how you can get involved and like how you can live your life. And what I find, because it talks about steampunk and solar punk and the history of it and everything, to my mind, I'm always interested in the philosophy behind things. So at the moment, one of the things I haven't referenced is that we're experimenting with a Slack book club at the moment. And so on to chapter 3 this week, and it's Cal Newport's new book, which is called Digital Minimalism. You know, he wrote Deep Work.
Yeah, we discussed digital minimalism. We talked about it. You said you'd got a copy of it on the last episode.
Yeah, so I decided to set up this book club, and there's quite a few people joined the Slack channel, and, influx of 20 people. Lots of discussion on there. It's great, and Brian Mathers is drawing things as he's listening to the audiobook. But the reason I reference it is because Cal Newport talks about how, you can do tips and tricks to be more intentional about your smartphone usage and whatever, but really you need a philosophy, an approach to life. And I feel like, although I wouldn't describe myself as a solar punk, I would certainly suggest that it's a more of a coherent philosophy, because it's not just, well, I'm just not going to eat meat. That's not really a philosophy of life. I guess veganism is more of a philosophy of life. But even so, you're still talking about what you're against rather than what you're for.
Mm-hmm. No, I think it's an interesting, it's definitely an interesting idea, isn't it? I have an aversion to anything with the word punk in it. Is that bad of me?
No, I don't think so. I can remember when people like Steve Wheeler and Jim Groom were talking about being edgy punks, and I just thought, no, you're not.
And I kind of got what they were saying. It's like, one of the things that I would say is that by calling yourself a solar punk, right, is you're just, I don't know what a good alternative word is, but you're just really alienating yourself from the mainstream. And I don't see the point in that, because I am the mainstream. And so I find it, you know, that's a burden I have to live with, whether I like it or not. I'm a privileged white middle-class man. So to call myself a solar punk is like to say I'm kind of cool. Do you know what I mean? I am cool, but not because I'm a solar punk. And it's sort of, do you know what I mean? I just find it's alienating. It's pushing people out. It's forcing people into a corner, forcing yourself into a corner, saying you lot aren't welcome here. We're going to sit over here and just punk our solars. you know what I mean?
I know where you're coming from.
That's where it's like the word anarchism, right? So anarchy, the origins of anarchism, the etymology of the word anarchy, which I love. It is not what I grew up thinking what the word meant from what it had been fed to me in the media.
No, because it was co-opted, right?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And it was about people trying to make society fair and equality and equal opportunities and inclusive, you know, and that's what anarchy was all about, and not about what it is that we were led to believe, this kind of riotous, let's smash everybody's property and there's no such thing as ownership, or the status quo needs to be broken and all that kind of thing. It's not what it was about. It was about fairness. It was about a positive movement towards something, which is what you're saying. It's something you stand for. It wasn't a fight against something. It was like saying, do something different to that.
This is the problem I have with a lot of people. I'm not going to name names because it's not fair, but there's a lot of people or a significant number of people in our networks who stand for the negation of something rather than standing for something positive. And I guess one of the reasons that I stopped banging on about privacy as much this year is because I realized I was turning into one of those people who was just against everything. Like, oh my goodness, look at all of this. This is terrible and that's terrible and whatever. And I suppose I still do a reasonable amount of that. But I hope that you and me and other people who we surround ourselves with are trying to have some kind of positive, coherent-ish view of life, which gives hope and for the future rather than just despair.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is the thing. I mean, I'm fatalistically optimistic, I guess, and it's because I step outside and I see the beautiful world, and I have connections with people every day. I'm a teacher, you know, and I have to make those connections positive and try it, but I get nourished by them as well, and it's this appreciation of what must be good in a day. And obviously I get down and low about things, but I have a professional responsibility not to take that into the classroom as much as possible, and I don't know, it's a weird thing, but yeah. Anyway, so I really like everything that Solar Punk stands for, and I'm going to find out more about it. I'm on solarpunks.net as we speak, but there's a video I'm going to watch explaining it all, and there's lots of really cool things in there. And in, you know, Asian is my cup of tea, African is my cup of tea. That's where I've been taking these dirty big aeroplanes to, but the word punk, I always
splutter. Yeah, fair enough.
I think it's because I grew up at a certain time after punk as well, sort of on the arse end of punk, and because I was born in 1971, and it was just something that told me that my life was all wrong, and I just thought, well, what's that all about? And then I just watched all the punks become normalized and middle class, and you kind of think, yeah, whatever.
Well, indeed.
Do you know what I mean?
There's a few things which we'll probably wrap up in about 15 minutes, but just thinking about which kind of rabbit hole to go down here, because we could go back to the Mobile World Congress on at the moment. So there's some interesting stuff around foldable displays. There's Stephen.
Okay, we'll answer that in one thing. Is a folding phone going to be something you ever want?
Yes.
Yeah, I think it possibly is. I think the only LED screens that bend, they're pretty cool, aren't they?
Because basically, I would say that sales of tablets are going down through the floor. Everyone in my family's got a tablet each. But what you really want is what they've announced at Mobile World Congress, which is a phone, which is the same size as one you've got now, but you can fold it out and it turns into a squarish tablet. That's awesome.
Yeah, potentially fantastic, isn't it? I mean, lots and lots of development needs to go on before that hits the market properly because of the software that will need to be built. It's just launched at $2,600. I'm assuming they're American, it says on your blog. It just looks like a dinky thing. Do we need it? Don't know. Will it actually serve a purpose? I do think there's a crossover between the phone and the tablet screen size, which this would cure. But again, I would always come back to the idea as we get into tech. I've been thinking about this a lot in education, to be honest, and is that you want things that do less things well, more things that do less things well, rather than having one thing that does everything Yeah.
Do you think that's true?
I do think that's true.
I don't think that's true. I think it's that we want fewer things to carry.
No, I think that's true, but I don't. Yeah, yes, and no. I don't think that's quite right. I think it's because when you have fewer things to carry, what you end up is dependent on one item, and being dependent on one item is
people trade almost everything for convenience. So, like, I until recently thought, why would I just want to carry my phone? Why wouldn't I want to carry a wallet? And then you think how liberating it is to just walk out of the house with literally just your well-charged phone. And to be able to go around and pay and look at maps and talk to people and do this and that and whatever. And I think as soon as battery life becomes like incredible, then the only thing you'd actually carry around with you really would be, your phone.
I know, I completely agree with that. But I tell you what, I think there's an interesting pitch here between tools and media. Right. So I've been looking at some stuff recently to do with giving your phone up, as it were, and sort of different. There's a Kickstarter thing called Light, a phone called Light, spelled L-I-G-H-T, and the Light 2 version, which I just put into Kickstarter. And it's an early, I think it's an e-ink phone, but it has tools on it. So it will do maps and it will do music and it will do this, that, and the other calls and text messaging. But it's the idea of just having tools and not having media consumption rabbit holes on your device, so that you're more intentional with that. And I'm not convinced by the argument, but I think there's stuff to explore in the argument.
I find it bizarre, and it's a kind of indicative of the kind of culture we live in, that you buy more stuff to do less stuff.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, if you don't want to use Instagram, delete off your phone. There you go.
I agree.
I think for me, one of the best things you can do with social media apps is only access them through the mobile web view.
No, I agree with that completely as well. Because and I've got people who are doing that.
You can get notifications through the mobile web view. They don't happen by default and you can turn them off. So, yeah, you're not notified. And I think this is the notifications. Certainly with testing MoodleNet, that's the thing that people miss most. They're like, well, I haven't come back because I didn't get any notifications that people had replied to me. For better or for worse. Obviously, as someone who's running a platform, you're like, oh, crap, I need to get notifications in there as soon as possible.
Yeah, of course.
From a user point of view, you think, well, that's a bit more of an intentional use, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah, I know. And that's the thing, though, isn't it? People do need reminding and prompting and this, that, and the other. And I have taken, and I do know a lot of people who are like taking Facebook off their phone, for example. So Twitter doesn't seem to be as killer, as it were, in this regard. So people don't spend forever on Twitter. I think it's because they get fed up with it too quickly. But Instagram, you can spend hours. So Instagram they're doing really clever algorithms. And I'm getting really sick and bored of it. I have really enjoyed it. But now I just, so you know how we were talking about how I got my news through Instagram by following The Economist and a range of broadsheet newspapers, quality newspapers from the UK. And other things. And this was great. But now what I'm finding, so I also follow a lot of sort of natural movement things like, barefoot podiatrist and that sort of thing. And what I found is that it's Instagram stories have become massive, which are just like Snapchat stories. So these little, 5 seconds of video or a still image with some annotation on it or not, no explanation, no text, just pictures, and you just step through them and they become really, really quite compelling. But now because of the way my Instagram account has balanced out, there are a dozen people, say, whom I know who are posting these stories. And then it's just all of the gumph and lots of advertising. And I find myself, so you get pulled into watching your feed of stories. So they go full screen and that's just what you're doing, just tapping through to the next image or whatever. And then the next person, the next image, the next person is just a natural scroll. Really lovely to consume, but you just find yourself, oh my gosh, I'm just getting the same information repeatedly, and I'm getting to these non-individuals, as into these organizations, these newspapers, magazines, whatever, and it's just So whereas I did find it insightful and really interesting to have insights into people's lives or into these organizations and what they were talking about, and now I just find it oppressive.
Yeah, it's
but what would you do on your phone? I mean, if you know, the less you use your phone, the more you will play Red Dead Redemption 2.
Well, this is true. This is true. And actually,
not a bad thing.
Oh, I tell you what's been really interesting. I'm not going to share specific quotes from the Slack book club because it's, although there's nothing stopping anybody going in there and joining us even halfway through the book and reading what other people have written, it's kind of a, it's not public. Like, you can't just anyone go and see what's there. But it seems most people reading the book are in a similar kind of position, that it's being treated as a form of addiction when it's not really addiction. Like, addiction suggests something that you don't really want to do, but you're doing against your better judgment. Whereas what we're doing is actually getting, you know, good stuff out of it. Like, we're getting connections and we're getting whatever. It's just that sometimes it's like a slot machine and, you know, it's endless scroll and whatever. For me, it's just being a bit more intentional about what you're doing on your devices. And just because you spend a lot of time on one device doesn't mean that it's not useful. So, for example, if you got rid of all my devices, I wouldn't be able to earn any money in the world, because that's exactly how I earn all of my cash. So it's kind of difficult, isn't it? Like, it has to be a balance. Yeah, there's no easy answers. But
I don't think there is an easy answer, and I think you're absolutely right. It is about how you see it. So I was having this discussion today back on the basis of the biohacker thing. The idea that, do we need this data, like the data that we collect about ourselves, the health data or whatever, do we need that data? Is it important? And I think, because, like, do you need to be told by your watch or your phone that you slept well and analyze your sleep? And it's like, I kind of know if I slept well or not, and I kind of need to get on the, you know, work that out for myself. And that self-awareness, that mindfulness, is actually really, really important. And will the data, which we're also sharing with companies, which will have its own influence in due course, which not all of that will be good, that influence. Some of it will be, I guess. But isn't it more important that we're more self-aware and that we're more, you know, I think that self-awareness, like the thing with Instagram, it's like, okay, Instagram's now doing my head in, I'm going to get rid of it and fill my life up with something else in that time that I spent on it, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, but I think that what works for one person doesn't necessarily work for another. So Cal Newport in his book is talking about a digital detox. And I see there was a New York Times article with a guy called Kevin Roos, who was talking about digital detox. There's the, like, Marie Kondo approach to house tidying, all this kind of stuff. Is if all you need to do is just disconnect for a bit and chill out. Now, I do this kind of thing every year. I do this kind of Belshaw Black Ops digital detox, go off social media for a bit every year. And it is fantastic. And every year I think I'm never going to go back to using social media again. And I find all this other stuff that I do. But there's a reason I go back, and it's not just addiction. I don't feel like I'm addicted. At one point, I feel I might have been addicted to Twitter. I don't think I am now. I maybe go on a couple of times a day, maybe three times a day, and I've got the tab open most of the time. But it's because it's useful. The connections on there are useful to me.
But I think that's right, isn't it? I mean, that's the point about being an active agent in your consumption, your use of these services. That action, that activity, is really important, that you do it with intention. You have some deliberate practice. Like, I talk about my students all the time about deliberate practice. It's so important to have deliberate practice in your life and to sort of go home and do some work for half an hour or do some work for 3 hours or whatever is needed to be done, and to make that, I need to do this work, I am going to do this, not to sort of land accidentally on a piece of work and you know, that, and encouraging them to have that sort of self-discipline or motivation is really important.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about whether to go down that whole rabbit hole of why it's so difficult to quit big tech and how everything's designed to work together and convenience and ease of use. I think maybe we'll just acknowledge that and move on, because again, there's articles being doing the rounds. I think it's because it's the start of the year about digital detox, organize your life, take back control, do this and that. Mm. Don't use Amazon and Google and Facebook and what have you. I must say that I don't use any Facebook products. My wife does. And we went away on Saturday and Sunday. And by Sunday morning, she was getting emails from Facebook and Instagram basically saying, like, what's going on?
Where have
all of your friends are liking these things, come back.
Yeah. No, it is a thing. Facebook did that to me. Well, I don't know. I have a diver on my Facebook emails. I don't receive any information. So I never go on Facebook unless I want to, which is very rarely. It's just an interesting thing about what struck me when you said about the digital detox. It's just like dry January.
Yeah.
Isn't it? That is what's going on. Anyway, let's call it a day there. It's nearly 10 o'clock.
Yeah. And for those who are listening, who are thinking, oh, what could Doug and I have got to? I'm just going to put a thing of things we didn't get to. And to whet your appetite, there are, I'll just run through the titles, 10 Platforms for Issuing Open Badges, a three-step guide to completing your thesis when you're feeling completely overwhelmed, a post about Stephen Wolfram and his system of being organized and productivity, open badges and alternative digital credentials, an interesting Ofcom report, which we probably should have talked about earlier, about what UK children are watching and why. Stephen Downes on whether edtech is even a thing anymore, whether or not we should allow children to get bored, the robot economy and social emotional skills, and also Ian O'Byrne and another researcher who start a new podcast and website called screentime.me, which is all about the construct of screen time. I'll also put links to surgery sessions, which I'm starting on a Wednesday, about where you can book me for half an hour to talk about anything you like. And also I'll put a link to the experimental Slack book club as well.
Cool. What are you up to in the coming week, month, ever?
Well, I was away, 3 times last week, including Barcelona. This week I am at home all week. My son, Ben, is off on his ski trip on Saturday, which is very exciting.
Very exciting.
The house will be feel empty without him because he's such a presence, I guess. Both my kids are, but especially my eldest. So that'll be interesting. And I am working on a data protection impact assessment, DPIA, for MoodleNet, which is extraordinarily boring to fill in, but absolutely necessary.
Mm, and sort of, it is boring, but the underlying principles are interesting. That's what I find about data protection.
They are, yeah, but having to fill in a form which is dictated by the Information Commissioner's Office is kind of tedious.
Yeah, absolutely. No, we did it. It took a long time.
How about you?
Spreadsheet. I am making instructional videos and teaching and more teaching. I don't think I've got anything big planned, particularly in the next couple of weeks. That's that.
Cool.
Normal life. Red Dead Redemption 2, some of that as well.
We need to play each other. We need to connect on the PlayStation. So
do that.
If you play on PS4, especially, and you want to be connected to DieRI, then let us know. Like, message us on Twitter. I'm at DAJ Belshaw. Die is at Die Barnes. And yeah, just message us on the usual channels and we'll get hooked up. Be good.
Yeah, it would. Do you need a microphone to play it? Like a headset?
You can talk to the people. I don't.
But if we were to like hook up in there, tied on Red Dead Redemption, we could do that.
We totally could do that. Yeah, so we could talk while riding around, looking at the beautiful things, shooting each other's heads off.
That's it. And like mucking about and whatever. We could have a Twitch channel maybe.
We could stream it out. We could be streamers.
Of Tide. Wouldn't that be awesome? So people could watch us poodling around because there's some great places in there.
I tell you what, let's get that sorted out for, if not next week, soon.
Yes, let's do that. It's making me excited.
If you want that to happen and you manage to get to the end of the podcast, let us know on the usual. Yeah.
Go on, please, someone just say yes. Just one person, say half a yes. That would be enough. Excellent. Have a fantastic week. Thank you for listening if you got this far. And it was lovely to talk to you, as always, Doug.
Likewise, Di. Cheers. I'm just going to sit at the dock of a bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, sitting on a dock of a bay.